I used to be able to name every nut that there was. And it used to drive my mother crazy because she used to say, Harlan Pepper, if you don't stop naming nuts. And the joke was, of course, that we lived in pine nut. And I think that's what put it in my head at that point. So I'd go to sleep. She'd hear me in the other room and she would just start yelling. I'd say, peanut, hazelnut, cashew nut, macadamia nut. That was the one that was sent her into a, going crazy. She said, you stop naming nuts. Pistachio nut, red pistachio nut, natural, all natural white pistachio nut, pine nut, which is a nut, but it's also the name of the town.
TBTL!
I'm going to suggest that we have a little constructive talking time.
What, you think I'm dressed to talk? I'm dressed to party hardy like an MC Scat Cat.
I don't know what you guys are up to, and I certainly don't know what butt hurt means.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I'd rather be up here with you than down there with those teenage people with their memes and their hashtags and Drakes.
Dusty man, damn!
Back at it again with a Tuesday afternoon edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
This is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host.
I don't want any more at any time during the day from anyone. That includes me.
Coming to you from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill in Bellingham, Washington, the Bay City. The Pod Dog.
I'll say, what's up, dog?
Pod Dog dealing with a, not so much a medical, but hygienic emergency. We just realized she has ear mites.
Oh, my God!
So she is currently visiting the vet to get the medicine, to get that worked out. I think she's been picking those ear mites up all around town because today, once again, one of the gates here at Burbank Springs was left open for just a matter of moments, and she just waddled her 65 pounds out of there and waddled down the street. Thankfully, this time she wasn't found lying in the middle of the busy, busy street down at the end of our street. She was just in a neighbor's yard, and I retrieved her, but was touch and go there for a minute. The Bay Kitty.
Kittens, inspired by kittens.
Bay Kitty doing her thing. So far, ear mite free, so that's kind of cool. Oh, you know what I'm excited about, you guys? Speaking of Burbank Springs, we got a new toilet in our bathroom.
For me, a bathroom is just a library with a cold seat.
We spent like a good 20 minutes today, me and my wife.
That's my wife.
My brother-in-law, sitting on the toilet and figuring out the best position for the toilet paper roll, or rather the, toilet paper roll holder to go. That's the kind of thing that you don't think about, but it's life-changing if you spend as much time on the toilet as I do. Also, I've never had a new toilet in my life. Like, I don't think anybody's used it, at least not for number two. I feel like there needs to be a ribbon-cutting ceremony. There's going to be a whole thing. I'm sure you'll hear about it on the show. So that's what's going on here. Here's what's going on with episode 2406 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
There is a tick called the Lone Star Tick, which is spreading and biting a lot of people. And what it does is make people permanently allergic to red meat.
You're entering a world of pain.
And after reading all about this tick, I may want to voluntarily submit myself to a bite from the Lone Star Tick. We'll talk about that. Also, as you well know,
if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11.
You know what doesn't seem to go to 11? The residuals that the original members of Spinal Tap, the band, which of course became the film, the guys like Harry Shearer and Michael McKean and Christopher Guest, they're not making any money on Spinal Tap anymore, even though they're contractually owed a significant portion of the revenues. So we'll tell you what's going on. They've sued the people who own Spinal Tap. The band Spinal Tap has sued Vivendi International, who owns the movie Spinal Tap. So we'll get into that. Oh, and speaking of music,
I'm the president of rap music, and I need to work with you right away.
We played a song yesterday, a snippet of a kind of mashup rap song that had a lot of bad stuff in it. And so it's a perfect time to read an email from a listener asking us why we have the policy we have about hip-hop music. So we'll get into that. And we'll do all of it with this guy. He's the Hodor of podcasting, known for his drawings of tall ships, their grace and their splendor, which doesn't mean he thinks he's better than anyone else. I'm not going to lie to you. Every once in a while, we need to hash it out before the show. We're dealing with some stuff right now, me and this guy.
If you can't serve tasty sausage, why are we even a family?
His name is Andrew Walsh, and he joins us now from the Wallingford neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Hello.
Hey, man. I have a joke for you.
Okay.
I thought a Lone Star tick is when you find yourself saying y'all all the time in Austin.
Oh, hey.
That's such a bad joke. It's also based on a false premise that you tried to do that, which you didn't even try to do. It was just I could just picture you doing it. I was worried that you were going to do it.
There were certain nights, though, that you passed out, and you don't know that I wasn't wandering the streets of Marfa or Austin or wherever, just yawling it up.
Hey, y'all. My buddy's sleeping. Hey, y'all. I'm out for a walk.
Exactly. I'm just trying to get it out of my system if I can. How's your Tuesday going, bud?
So far, so good. It is my mom's birthday. I just looked down at the calendar right before the show, and I realized it's my mom's birthday, so I have a piece of paper here that says Mom's B-Day. I need to remember to call her because you know how it is. It's a weekday. You get into your regular routine. I could see myself kind of finishing up the show here and then starting to prep the show I do with Veeves and just like these things have a tendency
to these messages.
Yes.
Great podcast about ads.
One of the most popular podcasts about television ads out there. And so I wrote down this piece of paper, Mom's B-Day. I'll be giving her a call after the show. Don't have a power out for that anecdote, though.
Well, I'll admit, because in our family we have this long-standing kind of ritual that I've talked about where, well, it just changed. Used to be you'd call and you'd sing happy birthday to you. But now it's become for he's a jolly good fellow or for you're a jolly good mama or whatever we're doing. My mom changed it recently because she's my mom and she got bored with the other version.
You're a jolly good mama.
I think I sang... Like on Mother's Day, I sang for She's a Jolly Good Mother just to mess with her. But more than once, I've made that call at like 11:55 p.m. Just trying to get it under the wire, which is almost – I guess it's better than just getting at them the next day and being like, I'm so sorry.
But
it's right on the line.
It's right on the line. I'm trying to think what is better. Well, first of all, I don't know how much you're exaggerating – does your mom really stay up until midnight every night? I wouldn't call any of my parents that late.
No, but it'll just go to their voicemail. I mean, they're not my nobody in my family like sleeps with their phone in close proximity to them. So if they're not near the phone, they're just not near the phone. But you'll get the credit for having gotten it in on the official day.
Side question.
So the theory goes.
Side question. When you call your folks, you usually call one of their cell phones? You don't call a landline number?
They don't have a landline.
Interesting. I'm surprised.
Yeah. I know. And it's ridiculous because they have horrible cell reception at their house. They live
in
the sticks. Yeah. And so, like, it's actually really frustrating if they're at home. I mean, not always. That's not true. It's not really. That would be overstating it. But it can be difficult sometimes to raise them. Or my dad was for a long time. I remember he had some kind of cell phone repeater magnifier thing he had bought somewhere that was supposed to kind of make the cell phone signal a little bit stronger.
And
I don't think it was that effective, but there's something like, by the way, I have a landline.
Yeah.
The reason I have a landline is because I have this weird irrational fear that there might be an emergency here and I, for some reason, won't be able to find the cell phone, but there will at least be a landline. And I do use a landline once every couple weeks. Like if I'm going to call someone and be on hold for a while, I'll break out the landline. But there's something about my parents not having a landline that makes me feel like part of my childhood has died.
It is, yeah, interesting. When I call my dad and stepmom back there in Ohio, I always call the landline first. Now, if I can't reach them and I really, want to reach them, I will call the cell phone of one of them. But for the most part, I just call the landline. Pardon me. I call the landline, and if they're not home, I leave them a voicemail, and then they'll get back with me. And there's something very – there's very few people I do that with in my life in this modern era, but that I do – I never thought about it before, but saying it now, I find it comforting.
Yeah, because as a kid, you're, so much of your life revolved around that landline. And if you were a cool kid, you had a cordless phone in your house. If you were a really cool kid, you had a football phone that you got free from ordering Sports Illustrated. but these were the levels of coolness of phone. And by the way, our family had none of these. Coolest phone, cordless. Second coolest phone, extremely long cord between the phone itself and the earpiece, so you could take that and you could walk it almost into another room.
Yes.
And like shut the door and have
such
some privacy.
An 80s thing. Yes. There's always one phone in the house that just had the long cord that like it could be hanging on the wall, but the cord would drip all the way down to the ground and coil up and then all the way back up.
Yeah. And then there was just regular rotary phone, which is what we were rocking.
I'm sorry to step away from the mic for a second. I'm hearing a weird – I just closed the window. I was going to try to keep this internal, but I can't. I want to make sure that there's not an animal in pain. I keep on hearing kind of through my headphones like a – let's just be quiet for Luke.
Yeah.
Let's just do a little quiet time.
Let's finally respect the listener's wishes and shut up.
Everybody quiet down. Okay, I'm not hearing it anymore. It was probably coming from the outside, but I really enjoyed yelling at everybody. That was a good feeling. Maybe that's a new component of the show. Andrew shouts.
I wonder how many of the listeners also went quiet for no reason.
Why were they talking over the podcast?
If we start whispering, the listeners will start whispering back for no good reason.
I do like it every now and then. We'll be describing something on the show and we'll be like, I'll bet you right now there's somebody on the bus trying to do that exact thing that we're describing. You know, like, okay, you take your hand, you rub it on your belly, but then you tap your head. Can you do that?
I'm thinking that, you know what? This has got me, this phone conversation got me inspired to we have a phone in the kitchen. It's a cordless because we're a cool family. Mm-hmm. The landline. And I'm really inspired. I do want to get one of those wall-mounted, like, old-school phones that a lot of people have in their kitchens. Would those work with a – I mean, you know, our phone line comes from the – it comes from the Lord, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Our phone line comes from, like, some, you know, internet thingy, whatever. It's like our cable. It's all bundled together. I wonder – yeah, I guess it, would a typical phone, like an old – oldish phone work with the newfangled phone technology?
Well, yeah. But
would that be the world's biggest affectation? If I took, we have a very functional, working wireless phone thing that you can just roam the house with. And if I were to replace that with something that was stationary and actually meant you couldn't go anywhere, I mean, that would be intentionally regressing by 30 years of technology just because you know how I get. Is that a super annoying affectation?
Well, there's a fine line between just style and affect, right? I mean, this is where these conversations kind of start to break down for me a little bit. As far as phones are concerned, I have this red broadcast phone that for the most part looks just like a normal old-fashioned red phone that would sit on a desk. This one, the only thing that makes it a broadcast phone is it's got a little tiny little red light on the top of it, kind of like the siren light that you would see at the beginning of old cop shows, right? A little bulb. But aside
police
from
squad.
That, Police Squad is the exact show I was thinking of. And you and I, we don't even need it anymore. With our IPDTL technology, that's the better way to get guests on the phone now. But I still love the way this thing looks. And if you have a cool house, and in this case, Luke, you do have a cool house. I've seen photos of it. Haven't gotten the invite yet, but have seen a lot of cool photos of it. And
we're having a party this Saturday.
That's why nobody's coming to ours. But you hang things on the walls to, you know, kind of amplify a certain kind of design sensibility. You choose furniture to go with a certain kind of design. If you already do have a use for a landline and you decide to go with a phone that fits your design sensibility a little bit, as opposed to kind of a more generic-y looking portable phone, is that an affectation or is that just having an eye for design?
Well, of course, because here's where my mind goes with all of this, as it always does with my technological fixes for emotional life. My feeling is if we have that phone in there, and then if someday we had little ones, and then they would be talking on that phone, and we'd all hang out in the kitchen, and we'd be a family like my family was in the 80s, which is just not realistic.
No, yeah, that's not going to happen.
But somehow I just think if we get that phone in there, I mean, it starts with the coat hook. If we get that hook situation ironed out, then we can move on to the landline phone, which then will be the phone that our kids use. You know, it'll be a whole thing where like our son is on the line, he's on a call for 20 minutes, but I'm waiting for a work call, but we don't have call waiting. I'm mad at him. It's going
to
be great.
Yeah, no, it sounds real pleasant. I hope just to be a fly on the wall. To be listen, I know I've said this on the show.
Dad, why do we live in a time warp?
I don't want to get bogged down on this because I know I've said it to you many times, but it is something that somebody pointed out to me that I find very interesting, and that is my old friend Sage, who you know Sage as well, used to work at KUOW. She mentioned one time that she really missed landlines because she sort of felt like the relationship between her wife and her parents is not the way it would have been 10 or 15 years earlier, because you call somebody's house and the parents might, you know, let's say the parents are trying to call Sage, but instead her wife picks up and then they just automatically talk for a little bit with cell phones. You just lack that. You know, if I'm calling my dad because we want to catch up, but my stepmom answers the phone, well, I'm going to talk to my stepmom for a while and catch up. Whereas if I'm calling my dad's cell phone, the chance of him at some point just handing the phone over to Joyce. I mean, it happens from time to time, but it's just not as organic, you know? And you do sort of I have memories of being a kid. I was such a sycophant, as you'd probably guess. So when I got older and started kind of having friends in high school, I would call my friends on the landline and their parents would pick up. And then I would kind of, you know, chat with the parents a little bit. I liked being a parental favorite.
Bet your parents parents love you.
I'm not gonna lie, I was pretty good at those people's parents, and I liked them too. And that's the thing. Sure. It wasn't a total.
You weren't an Eddie Haskell.
Eddie Haskell. Yeah, I almost said Eddie Fisher. That would be different. I wasn't a total Eddie Fisher about it, but I just I developed almost independent relationships with some of my friends' folks. You know, that we would have our own kind of conversations and stuff.
Yeah. I was going to say that I was a favorite of parents. I was only a favorite of certain kinds of friends' parents, because I think I was like overly talkative, overly curious, and sometimes I think they thought that I was kind of a delightful little weirdo. And then some parents really just dreaded me coming over. But I just remember, and I know I've talked about this before, but like the main guy I hung out with growing up was a kid named Peter Williams, and I love his parents. They're great. And they, were so sweet to me, but also, you know, had an eye on the bottom line. And there would be like, we'd be playing and Peter would go like, we're going to Red Robin. I'm going to ask do you want to go? I'll ask my parents. And to me, that was like, I mean, that was just an amazing, amazing bit of good fortune if I got to go to Red Robin. But his mom would say, fine, Luke can come, but nobody gets a soda.
Oh, I remember you telling me about that.
Yeah, because the addition of me meant the deduction of everyone getting a $1 soda. So the Williams family would go without carbonated beverages so that the urchin Luke Burbank could tag along.
Oh, man.
I don't know. The other thing was once I broke Peter's tooth. God, I hope this isn't the
kid.
First time.
Yeah, right.
I hope this isn't the first time Diane's hearing this. I broke Peter's tooth with a Nintendo controller, like threw it at him because I was mad because we were playing this video game. But he knew well enough that if he told his mom that it snapped clean off in the middle of the tooth. And he knew if he told his mom that that's how the tooth got broken, I would be like banished probably forever from the house. So we concocted this ridiculous story about how we were playing basketball and the basketball hit him in the mouth, which made no sense from like a physics or geometry.
Well, sometimes you confuse basketballs with bowling balls. And on this particular day, you're playing basketball with a bowling ball, which makes
sense. And that was where the trouble started.
Yeah.
And his mom was like, okay, well, where's the rest of the tooth? Because it was going to be more to have like a fake tooth made than to just reattach the existing tooth. And he said, I think I swallowed it. And then his mom said some of the most famous words in our childhood, which is, I will dig through shit to find that piece of tooth.
And she
did,
right?
And we would say that to each other.
Didn't she?
I don't think she did, actually. No, I think he just kind of – I think – actually, you know what? Maybe she did. I know that what happened was he had the tooth fixed, obviously, but then the part that was fixed was never – it kind of went a little more gray than the rest of his tooth. We used to call that part of his tooth Old Baleen. We had a nickname. This was the kind of friendship we had. We had a nickname for part of one of his teeth.
How did that name come about?
Because of a baleen gray whale.
Oh, I don't know.
We thought that it was roughly the color of a baleen whale.
That's very high-minded of you. I like that.
We had a lot of spare time. you know what? All of these great stories that I'm thrilling listeners with unfolded during the summer. And you know what another summer tradition is, Andrew? The TBTL Song of the Summer Contest, which is back, baby. It's back. And we're taking submissions from people at tbtl.net. There is a cool intake form that our friends at APM Digital built for us. So thank you.
I was just I just hacked my way into the back end of okay. I was going to say something.
How he gets out of this one.
Oh, man, I don't know what I was about to say. Out of context, that wouldn't have been great. I just got permission from our dear friends and colleagues at APM to access all of the information that's coming in. So this is probably not exciting to anybody except for me. But in the past, everybody would fill out a little form, and I would get an email for every single submission. And I would spend all this time. I believed at the time that it was part of my process. It was my way of making sure I listened to every single song. But I would take every email, copy and paste into my own document, move things around. It was a very tedious way of doing things, which I was married to up until that point. But this year, I now have a spreadsheet, Luke. I have spreadsheet technology. I can sort by artist. I can sort by song. I can sort by last name. As a matter of fact, I figured out today that there is a couple, a listening couple, who's just basically nominating every single song off of the new Kendrick Lamar record. Between the two of them, I'm up to my ears in Kendrick Lamar. Can I ban them? I don't know. I'm still talking to the people at APM about that. But yeah. It's fun for you and it's fun
for
us.
I'm the president of rap music.
And I need to talk to you right away. So if you don't know what we're talking about, just go to tbtl.net and there's a little place where you can click. And any song that you think should be the official TBTL song of the summer, it's open nominations right now.
And it's real fun. If you haven't been through one of these procedures with us before, which is a really nice way to put it, I think.
No, we're both.
You're going to feel a little pinch. It's like a March Madness bracket. Everybody submits songs and we play some of the songs and kind of give folks a sample of what's coming in. And then at some point we narrow it down to a certain number. What is it going to be this year?
The top 16, right?
Top 16 songs. I think it's like that.
It's like a bracket system.
And then each week we'll kind of have you guys will vote at the website, and you'll probably have some favorites and probably some ones you hate, and it's just a fun little competition that ends up with us deciding on what the TBTL song of the summer is. Speaking of music, we played a song yesterday to end the show by the Hood Internet, which is actually a couple of guys who do that crazy mashup thing where they take a couple of different songs and combine them. I'm very much a fan of their work. But we were trying to find something that had to do, I believe, with the word freeze, because the guy in Atlanta at the Braves game called the Freeze, who was racing a random Atlanta Braves fans in between innings, he had lost. And so we wanted something freeze related and landed us on this song, which had Gucci Mane and a bunch of other rapper dudes on it. We started playing it. And we had speculated going in. I was like, I think the Hood Internet keeps it pretty clean. That was my memory anyway. And I don't know where the name the Hood Internet led me to believe that they're keeping it pretty clean. But within 8 seconds of the song airing, the N-word had aired 7 times and the F-word had aired like 2 or 3 times. And we just like stopped and we're like, well, that didn't really work out. And so then we intellectually went the complete, or I should say creatively, we just did a real 180, went with Ted Leo and the Pharmacists.
Which I have a feeling that song is a little bit more raucous than I remembered it. Were you okay with that? I could see, I felt you wincing on the other end, I thought.
No, I wasn't wincing. Oh, I was fine with that. Yeah, good. But that gets us to this email that listener Dewan wrote in a while ago. And Dewan said, I'd like to start this off by saying I like you guys. I've donated and I listen to just about all of your podcasts. Thank you, Dewan. We appreciate that. I won't waste any more time stroking you, and I'll get right to Dewan's in on the act of the unfortunate entendre today. It's quite a theme. I'm going to get right to the inevitable turn. You guys put on a good podcast with seemingly little editing or censoring. Again, you've listened to the show, Dewan. You've noted that there's little editing or censoring. He says, I like it that way. At the conclusion of your podcast, there's always a song. With occasional frequency, that song is a hip-hop song. When this occurs, you two seem to fret about finding an edited version of the song, or you edit it yourself. That strikes me as odd that the language you are looking to remove from the songs is essentially the same language that you've used in the course of the recording. Why is it that the same words when used by a hip-hop artist is unacceptable, but it is acceptable for you to use? I want to understand the root reasoning for the editing. Does it sound threatening or aggressive coming out of their mouth? Don't get me wrong. The last thing I want is for you two to stop speaking freely. I just don't want you guys altering a work of art, yours or theirs. Power out. Okay, so that's the question. And Dewan is right. We have this conversation, I would say, once every 2 weeks whenever we're about to play hip-hop, because you and I both like hip-hop, and we both like a lot of hip-hop that uses words and messages that, despite what Dewan's saying here, I would argue that there are words and messages that we typically don't use on this show. For instance, the N-word, not a word that we would ever utter on this show, even for effect. And so when a hip-hop artist says it, they have every right to put that in their song. But I do get complicated feelings when I'm then putting that out on our airwaves. That's their music. That's their right. I listen to that music. But now to play it for all of our listeners, some of whom want to hear that word and some of whom don't, I get a little nervous about making that decision for our listeners, I guess. It's part of where my agita comes from.
Yeah, when it comes to the N-word, which is how I'll refer to it, which I think that can grate on people as well. So I'll try to say as little as possible. But when it comes to that word, this is just kind of a personal decision or feeling that I have. And I actually wrote this to Dewan, and I said, this might sound totally silly to you, but, you know, Luke and I are a couple of white guys. There's not tons of diversity.
I don't know if the listeners know that.
Well, now they know. Now they know.
Is everybody sitting down?
There's not tons of diversity on this show. And I get a little – I don't know if the word co-opt is the right word. But I get a little bit uncomfortable just personally when white people think it's okay to kind of adopt or adapt that word in the context of music. Let me give you an example. I have friends who work on another podcast, and they were having some sort of, I don't know if it was a competition, they were having fun, whatever it was, and they were challenging each other to rap some song, and it had the N-word in it. And I'm just like, and they just did it, like, on the podcast. And I'm like, that's their decision, and I don't think that they're racist people, and I think that they just like rap music, and that's part of the song. But just me personally, as being a white guy, I'm not super comfortable, like, in a karaoke situation. I'm not comfortable singing in karaoke anyway, but in a karaoke situation, if that word comes up, like, that is just, I just, you know, some people might be able to make a very reasoned argument why that's what the art is, and it's fine. But, you know, as a pretty white guy without a lot of diversity in my life, I'm not super comfortable just being like, yeah, making a decision that, yeah, it's okay for me to say that because it's in a song. So I just try to, you know, that's what kind of goes into my thinking in the end music. I know that we're not singing over top of it and the words aren't coming from our mouth, but we're not exactly, you know, slaying it in the diversity world. So I don't sort of think that it's okay for us to necessarily just go and be like, it's okay for us to associate ourselves with that word.
Well, and then there's also the message in a lot of hip hop music, which can be tremendously, you know, anti-woman and violent. And again, I'm making it sound like I don't like hip hop. I love that shit. We were listening to plenty of it driving to Austin. But for, like, what you and I would listen to, just the two of us, and what we would then put onto a recording that goes out to thousands and thousands of people, including, like, their kids riding in the car seat in the back. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of, like, voicemail messages we get from small children saying things related to the show. And I just feel like if their parents want them to hear about Lil Wayne's sexual prowess, I just feel like that's a call their parents probably want to make. And so, like, within their own family, they'll decide when it's time for their kids to learn just how Lil Wayne slays it.
Right.
I don't know if we want to be the people enlightening them on that topic prematurely. So back to Dewan's email, I think that if it's the simple, if it's the F word, or which, you know, we do say that if we say the F word semi-frequently, we say shit probably a lot. If it's a song that has the F word or shit in it, I don't think we're going to bleep it. I don't think we're going to get that freaked out. If it's a song that talks about F wording someone in a way that just seems tonally a little weird for what we usually talk about on the show, we would definitely probably try to bleep that or just skip that song. And again, if it's the N word, if the, and I don't think that Dewan is accusing us of this at all. Dewan went to great pains to say he likes the show and, you know, he's not, I don't think he's trying to be critical. I think he's just trying to understand. But if my gravestone says played it too carefully on the N word, I'm cool with that.
Yeah, right.
You know, like if that's where I just feel like there's limited upside to especially white people taking a liberal approach to the use of that word for themselves. You know, so I don't want to be back to what you were talking about. I don't want to be that guy, that white guy at the party who's like, you know, singing along to Kanye and he feels so in the moment that he feels okay just saying that, you know, she ain't messing with no broke N word. I mean, there's a reason why there's a version of the song where they say she ain't messing with no broke. Does it rhyme? No. Does it scan as well? No. Is that the version that I'm going to sing? Yes.
In karaoke, our friend Nick will change it to Ninja, which I think is an interesting
approach. I could see
there's
that.
Other ones as well. But anyway, and also just to go back to the regular swearing, which I'd like to name this show.
I was just going to write that down.
If I don't think you feel the same way about this. I don't know if you do. But me personally, if our bosses said, nah, no more swearing, don't say anything that you can't say on the radio, just as far as those words are concerned, I'd be fine with that. We've gone through phases where I've told you, like, I want to stop swearing. Maybe it was because I had a radio show at night and I wanted to get out of the habit of swearing into mics or whatever. I don't think that I am the best sounding person when I'm throwing the occasional shit or F word in there. Now we do it every now and then. I actually think the F word, I think it's somewhat rare, but it tends to be a somewhat just of a punctuation. And I think you did a really good job of kind of explaining how I also feel about the context of it. Like an occasional F word, if you're like, ah, that F and door, it keeps opening on me, is very different than, as you say, Lil Wayne going into a great detail about how he's effing someone, like, and that's kind of it is all about the context when it comes to that. But also, if somebody said, "Hey, clean your act up, guys," like, you're not making the show any better because you can say shit from time to time,
which people have said before.
And then other people, it is true. Then we have, I think the listeners are probably split on this. A lot of people say, you know, it's driving me crazy hearing you guys like try to dance around words. Just more annoying, and that's a taste thing, I guess.
Part of the problem is that we don't have a consistent style guide for what we do and don't say.
Oh,
so it's like
God.
Half, you know, I'll say doggam father mucker one show for because I don't feel like swearing that day. And then I'll just totally use the F word on other shows. This is, by the way, Andrew, you said you don't swear, but this is taped from, I think it was three weeks ago before we went to Austin.
Michael was adjusting to the absence of his son by enjoying the company of his brother.
You know, I'm in pretty good shape. You could be eating my dust all day, slowpoke.
This is your part.
And Buster was starting to give as good as he got.
And you might be eating that's gonna. Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that.
That was me.
Yeah,
I was the cool guy who
hoped
it didn't come to that. You were the guy that went too far.
Someone should make a TV show about us. Also, we should make a TBTL style guide, by the way. I love the idea of a TBTL style guide. It'd either be really short or really long.
Are you drunk or white? I guess that's the elements of style, not to be confused with the AP style guy.
Yeah, that's kind of at first when you said strunk, I thought you were just making up some word like I'm both stoned and drunk. Isn't there a word for that?
I think it's strunk.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
All right, I'm going to start off talking about the latest with Spinal Tap. And if we get to the tick story, we get to the tick story. But if not, this is – I don't – for whatever reason, I I'm obsessed with this story as of right now. It was – I mentioned yesterday that I was reading the latest issue of GQ, which is like the comedy issue, which just means they talk to a lot of people in comedy. And one of them was Harry Shearer, who maybe you haven't seen the movie Spinal Tap, but if you've watched The Simpsons, he's the voice of like 13 characters, something insane, you know. Principal Skinner, Ned Flanders, and then 11 more characters whose names elude me at the
moment. I'm
trying
to think, yeah. Anyway, that'll be torturous. Yeah. That'll be worse than me trying to dance around swear words if I try to conjure that list.
But he's one of the original voice actors on The Simpsons, and he's been in a lot of things and has a – he had a radio show on KCRW called Le Show for a long time. He still does it, I think, in some fashion from New Orleans. Anyway, he played Derek Smalls in the movie Spinal Tap, which if you've seen it, he was the bassist. He was the guy who had the as they tried to go through the metal detector, he has the zucchini that's rolled in foil that he's got in his tight pants, trying to look real kind of rock star, and then he eventually has to take them out of his tight pants. I was reading this interview because basically the members of Spinal Tap, the guys that are in the band, which is Harry Shearer on bass, Michael McKeon, who played David St. Hubbins, the lead singer guy, and then Christopher Guest, who played Nigel Tufnell, famously of This One Goes to 11. Also, Christopher Guest was Corky Sinclair and was in all those other really great kind of mockumentary movies.
And the guy we heard at the beginning of the show.
Yes, that's right. He's Harlan Pepper, Name and Nuts from Best in Show. So those three guys – oh, and Rob Reiner, the director of the movie, and also he played – I don't know if I need to explain Spinal Tap. I feel like it's one of those things that for people our age, Andrew – actually, it's one of those things I think that for people 5 years older than us was like – if they liked comedy, they loved Spinal Tap. I think we're almost a little on the young side of it. And then people who are 10 years younger than us are really on the young side for it. So
it's culty, so I think probably most of our audience is familiar. But give your quick NPR lead. Like you're reading a lead about this story, and you got to give a real quick explanation.
The Batman.
The bat signal, for those who don't know.
So Spinal Tap was this fake documentary about this kind of aging, kind of British heavy metal band that's on a tour of the U.S. And as they go along, things are increasingly falling apart. The venues are getting smaller and smaller. They are not selling any records. They're having these disastrous, you know, record signing events, and the band also is falling apart because the lead singer is fighting with the lead guitarist and their drummers keep dying or spontaneously combusting. And this whole thing apparently came about, the idea came from Christopher Guest. He was in a hotel in the UK and he was in the lobby and he happened to be sitting by some old aging kind of British band. And he was listening to their totally inane conversations.
I didn't know that.
And this sort of idea for Spinal Tap was born. So then he got together with these other dudes. Oh, and by the way, Rob Reiner, he is both really the director of Spinal Tap and also plays in the movie. He plays a documentary film director named Marty DeBerge, who is ostensibly making this documentary about Spinal Tap. So that's why we're seeing all this footage of Spinal Tap, because Marty DeBerge is making a movie about them. At the risk of using a much overused term on this show, it is extremely meta because it's sort of a movie within a movie. If you haven't seen it, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It is top five movies for me of all time. It is, I could sit here and just like quote all my favorite lines, which would be extremely boring for the listeners. I could play tons of Spinal Tap audio, which would be slightly less boring, but still pretty boring for the listeners. Suffice it to say, it's a great, great movie. You should go see it. They made it for $2.5 million. They had a really hard time, actually. This article I was reading in GQ, they had a difficult time actually getting it made because they shot this 20-minute trailer that was them in full like Spinal Tap character, and they took it around to all the studios, and every single studio turned them down. I think Harry Shearer in the article says something like, this is how it would go. We would sit in a dark room. We would play the screener. The lights would come up, and the film executives would go, "What the hell did I just see?" Like, nobody got what it was about. By the way, to get Spinal Tap together, they wrote these elaborate backstories for the band and for each character. And the actors, the improvisers, had to memorize their backstories so they would have internalized it so everything would be consistent. Because when Rob Reiner's interviewing them, they have no idea what questions he's going to ask them.
Oh, really? So it's like going undercover.
Yeah. So they wrote these really complicated, like very kind of carefully plotted out backstories for the characters and for the band. So they would have this kind of almost knowledge as if they really were the character, as opposed to just completely winging it. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to stay consistent to the story that they'd invented for everybody within this universe of Spinal Tap. Finally, they got it was Norman Lear's production company agreed to make the film. Again, it was like $2.5 million when they made it. And it went on to generate, let's see here, $2.25 million. And according to – now just think about like the movie Spinal Tap and think about all the people who've talked about it. Think about all the references that have been made to it. Think about all of the comedy careers that have been launched because of Spinal Tap. According to Vivendi Universal that owns Spinal Tap these days, they say that in the history of the movie Spinal Tap, it has generated less than $5 million in U.S. ticket sales.
Wow.
They're arguing that it has made less than $5 million, and therefore it is okay that since 1984 – and by the way, I should mention that the contract that the guys from Spinal Tap, which again is the three members of the band and Rob Reiner. The contract they signed in 1982 said they're due 40% of all net receipts that emanate from the film and 50% of gross receipts related to the music. So anything having to do with the film or the music, which is campy but is, I think, incredibly good as parody music. Big Bottoms, She's Got 'Em. How can I leave that behind? That's, I mean, come on. That is just, that's beautiful writing.
I mean, so a lot of that stuff was sold, as kind of comedy albums, but also I think growing up, I don't think I realized the first time I heard the word Spinal Tap that it was a fake band. Like, they were just always around. I grew up with a lot of kids wearing a lot of heavy metal t-shirts to school. I wasn't allowed to listen to any of that stuff. So I guarantee you the first couple of times I heard the word Spinal Tap and somebody had a Spinal Tap album, everybody had that album except for me. And I
100% assume Spinal Tap was just a different devil band I didn't know about.
Right, yeah. So are you saying that the company was just like straight up cooking the book, saying that like they were making a lot of money, but just saying that they weren't?
So since 1984, so from 1984 to 2013, the four creators, that is the people in the band and Rob Reiner, their share of total worldwide merchandising income from Spinal Tap, worldwide merchandising income, 1984 to 2013, was $81. Their share of music sales for the similar period, total worldwide music sales or the use, I assume, of like a Spinal Tap song in another movie or in a commercial or whatever, their total share for that same period of time, $98.
Hmm.
So they have now sued Vivendi for $400 million. Here's what the suit charges: fraud, breach of contract, abuse of power as part of an intentional scheme to deprive them of what was legitimately theirs. Central to the band's case, by the way, this is Amy Wallace writing in GQ. Central to the band's case is the claim that Vivendi has been hiding millions of dollars in profits from Spinal Tap by packaging the movie with flops, an accounting trick known as cross-collateralization. Now, you probably listened to what, The Big Pool of Money, remember the This American Life? Mm-hmm. Really great kind of breakdown of tranches and collateralized debt obligations. That shit has nothing apparently on what the film industry does with its bookkeeping. It's just unbelievable. I don't have it right in front of me, so I'm slightly doing this from memory. But in this article, it also talks about, I want to say it's one of the Harry Potter movies. Okay, so just imagine a Harry Potter movie, mm-hmm. right? They're saying that it's made, it's like north of $400 million, probably more at this point. I mean, those movies are insanely popular. And yet, according to the studio that produced it, it has lost money because they, first of all, they charge insane amounts of money for the marketing and distribution of the film. Then they have these other production companies that do certain things related to the film, which they also own, but they can pay those production companies. And so what they can do is take a movie that makes $500 million, and they can, through all kinds of complicated bookkeeping, they can make it so that movie lost money on paper, which means they don't have to pay out all the people who have residual payments coming to them for the success of the movie. That, I mean, just the idea that the guys from Spinal Tap are getting $81 for over a decade of Spinal Tap's existence. They're getting I get more from doing one story for This American Life about a guy dressed like Superman. I get a check for like $25 a year for them. They must still sell like CDs or something that has it on there. Like, I have made more money off of that story than the guys from Spinal Tap have made off of Spinal Tap.
I know you don't have the answer to this, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but I don't understand how that's legal. Like, this just sounds like mafia shit. I hope everybody's happy.
Ooh, I hope they are too. Let's see here. I'm gonna go back to the original article. You know why I don't have the entire article with me, Andrew, is because it's really long, and trying to print it out, it was doing some crazy ass formatting shit. So I basically just kind of cherry picked what I thought were the most dazzling of the deets.
You've got I'm gonna send you an app, man. Do you use Chrome?
You know what? I need to just go for it with Chrome. I do. I always find Chrome to be better at blocking things and just remembering things. I like Chrome.
Well, even if you don't want to, I'm just going to give an ad here. Even if you don't want to install the Chrome extension for this, if you just go to printfriendly.com, that thing changed my life. You just put the URL in there. I learned this over at the talk station when I was filling in not too long ago.
Okay, not too long ago. It better not have been when you first got there, because that's like 4 years of our life that you've known about this and not told me.
No, well, I was waiting for the right opportunity.
And that
was,
you found it,
my friend. In the middle of an interesting conversation about the history of one of the most famous movies. It's printfriendly.com. Give it a shot. You just put the URL in there, and then it'll get rid of most of the ads, and the ones that are still there, you can just click and get rid of them and then hit print. It's amazing.
By the way, so the let me tell you the Harry Potter story, because I'm back on the story.
Okay,
now.
Good.
It was Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. It grossed $612 million for Warner Brothers. The net profit statement shows a loss.
Here's the breakdown. Sort of legal
bookkeeping. Here's how Warner Brothers did the math for that movie. A $211 million distribution fee that came right off the top, plus an additional $131 million in advertising and publicity, some of which was likely spent on TV networks owned by the studio's parent company, Time Warner, and $61 million for, quote, other expenses, stuff like prints of the movie, dubbing, and shipping. Then came the studio's $313 million in negative cost. That's what the film cost to make. And nearly $58 million in interest that was owed. The bottom line, the film was said to have lost $167 million.
Well, I think then the lesson here is that we should all just be so grateful that the folks in Hollywood can still make movies when they're just sacrificing their bottom lines like this for us. And they just want to see us entertained. And they're good people.
Amy Wallace cites this line from David Mamet in Speed the Plow, which is a play about the American movie business. Quote, two things I've learned 25 years in the entertainment industry. The first one is, there is no net, and I forget the second one.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So, and the other thing that she writes about in this article is that apparently what usually happens, I'll just read directly from what she wrote. When it comes to the lawsuits this system inevitably provokes, studios prefer to settle rather than open their books to scrutiny. What happens usually is they tell the story about the guy who made the movie The Full Monty, a guy named Peter Cattano. He was the director of The Full Monty, which made they made The Full Monty. You remember that, right? About the guys who are
the dancers.
They're the unusually body typed male dancers who I think had worked like in an eastern town. They forgot to shut down, in the words of Morrissey. So while the Full Monty cost $3 million to make and it had taken in almost $200 million worldwide, this director, Cattaneo, was not yet due any residuals from the movie. $3 million to make, $200 million in ticket sales. They're at Spago. This guy and his agent are sitting at this like fancy Wolfgang Puck restaurant, Spago, in L.A., and they're talking about this. And as it happens, a guy is walking past them named Bill Mechanic, who is the head of Fox's movie studio. And the agent of this guy grabs him and sits him down, and they go over the accounting statement. And the guy from Fox says, "We owe you some money." The next day, Fox delivers this guy a $1 million check.
It sounds so like I guess a scene from The Player. That's right? Crazy.
If you're at Spago and the president of the studio walks by, you might be able to get some relief. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like basically the studios want to do anything they can to keep their particular style of accounting off of the radar of the courts, and they definitely don't want transparency. And so if you have a semi-legit claim, they may settle with you just so they don't have to go to court and open up their books, because it sounds like – I mean, honestly, the whole industry is really built on this totally ridiculous notion of writing everything down as a loss, no matter how successful it is.
It's built on this whole notion of not paying the people who are making the movies.
Right. Yeah.
Harry Shearer is kind of – just worth noting that Harry Shearer – you know, kind of has a reputation for being a pain in the butt in Hollywood.
Yes.
I didn't swear there. You know, he's the one who's always holding off for the Simpsons deals. He owned, like, the headlines about a year ago was that he wasn't going to do the newest season of the Simpsons. They're going to have to get people to come in and do imitations of his voices, which, by the way, would that have really hurt the show that much? I don't know. But
he
know.
Also does Mr. Burns. Oh, and I think this point, I mean, I'm sorry to jump in,
but no,
they mentioned in the article, I think that Harry Shearer's like 74 now. And even though I don't watch The Simpsons every week, I will tell you that when I do catch it, I always find at least something I'm enjoying mm-hmm. going on in it. Like, you know, the characters of Mo Sizlak and Homer Simpson will never not be fun for me. And so I get a little worried when I hear that, you know, some of the main voices are 74 years old. But then it's like that they can find somebody who can do a Mr. Burns impression that I honestly would not be able to tell the difference on.
That's what I meant. I wasn't throwing shade at Shear by saying that, because he created this character, and I'm not saying that he should be, you know, kind of pushed out of the way. But at this point, that show's been on the air for 30 seasons or something. Like, there are hundreds of people, some of whom are in junior high right now, who can do a perfect Mo Sizlak. So I'm not too worried about that. But my point was not to say that Harry's on the wrong side of this. I think that this story gives you perspective. You know, you can read the occasional headline about like Harry Shearer is pulling in all this money from The Simpsons, yet he's the one who is going to be a holdout for more money. And you kind of get this idea that somebody's just like really greedy or something. Yeah, or a malcontent. But then you hear stories like this, just like studios. This goes, I think, from the music side as well. You know, just studios just really blocking the people who are making the art from a lot of the stuff that they are due. And it really kind of puts it in the context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had heard the same thing about Harry. In fact, I've never met Harry Shearer, but I definitely know people that have done events with him and dealt with him. And he is notoriously a bit of a tough customer. But what he keeps saying in this interview is that he's not even doing this really because he personally needs the money. He's doing it because he's trying to set a precedent. I mean, even the thing he did with The Simpsons, he got all of the people who are the actors for The Simpsons a bunch more money. But I think for him was really the principle of the matter, which was fair's fair. And so I don't think he's doing this latest Spinal Tap thing because if he's doing it for the money, because he's really mad about that, mm-hmm. like he needs that money, there's something, he has a gambling problem or something, because Homeboy has made plenty of
right,
dough.
Right.
But I do think he's just kind of an irascible guy that when he thinks there's an injustice that pertains to him and his work, he is not. I mean, this is the thing he says a couple of times in the article is if he has one kind of life theory, it's, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but it's something to the effect of fight back or become roadkill. That's, you know, that's sort of his, that seems to be the guiding principle of his life. A couple of other just quick, you could say dazzling deets on Spinal Tap. Again, as such a fan of the movie, I just like voraciously consume any inside dirt on the movie or sort of backstory. I said already that they had like the guys that were playing the band Spinal Tap had like obsessively learned these backstories of their characters and everything. They were also, again, from Amy Wallace's piece, they were unrelenting in their pursuit of authenticity. One day they were scheduled to shoot a scene backstage in a club. The stage direction called for typical backstage graffiti on the walls. Harry Shearer says, we walk in and it looks like the art director had visited freeway underpasses near Mexican gang areas. So I guess that was not the right kind of graffiti. So we say, no, here is the phone number for the troubadour. Go to the troubadour and go upstairs and we'll wait. So they made the set director go to the troubadour, where we once did TBTL Live, by the way. Go upstairs, look at the band graffiti, which is more just like people writing on the wall in like ballpoint pen and Sharpie. It's not like full on spray painted, you know, stuff. There's probably something written in there by Rob Corddry when he was sitting upstairs just getting housed, waiting to finally come down and do his spot on stage at TBTL Live. Anyway, they would not – basically, the set decorator had to go to the troubadour, study the kind of graffiti that's really in like a green room, come back and redo the whole thing. So they were like – they were that serious about some of the details, which I think is why you can watch this movie in 2017, all these years later, and – find it totally enjoyable and mostly enjoyable with the knowledge that Harry Shearer is not getting a thin flipping dime
of the residuals. That kind of attention to detail goes back also to what you're talking about before, about them having to learn their entire backstories. I find that kind of stuff fascinating because I think this movie is brilliant. And then when you hear about the actual brilliance that goes into it, I think you were talking about this a little bit with Bill Murray and one of his iconic scenes that I can't think of off the top of my head right now. About him working with other comedians and writers and filmmakers and him just having this idea of what really works and what doesn't, and that he's really working at it. And he's kind of a genius when it comes to this kind of stuff. And the attention to detail that you're hearing about from these guys, it almost justifies your love of a movie like this, because it's not just, well, some people are funny and they can go on camera and be funny, right? Like, so much goes into the stuff that truly rises to the top in many cases.
And I mean, look, I'm the world's worst improviser. I really am. Like, whenever we try improv games on Livewire, like as a way of trying to have a clever moment with a guest, like one time we did this improv game with Ken Jennings where you have to just, it was called Questions and Appetizers. And we were like eating appetizers and you have to keep responding with a question, if that makes sense. So he would ask a question and then I was supposed to respond with a question. I would break down after like 4 seconds. Like, I could not, I am terrible at improvising and terrible at improv games. But for me anyway, the thing I've always said is that the secret to really good improvising is a lot of planning. Like, which of course seems like the antithesis of what improv is. But when you read about this and all of the work that went into getting it ready, so then they could be free to really improvise this amazing stuff, it makes me feel less bad about how terrible we are at improvising and riffing.
I know. Well, the worst thing for me is I actually do have this all written out, and it still sucks. All right. I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to TBTL.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to TBTL.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week, I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man, it's not from a female.
Hey, All right, so
we got a little TBTL breaking news, Andrew.
Yeah.
Which I can't play because I'm playing the Duke theme.
Yeah.
But Rudy the pod dog has ear mites.
Oh yeah.
And so Carrie took her to the vet, and she just texted me, "We have a 77-pound yellow lab."
Oh, what was the target?
Well, okay, we used to call her a 65-pound yellow lab. Then one time when she ran away, they weighed her and she was 80 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But we have been way cutting her food back. And I swear to God, like when people who know her see her, they're like, God, she's really losing weight. Like we're so proud of her. We're telling her all the time that she's looking good. She's only down 3 pounds. That's insane.
Oh. I thought it was good news. You might be surprised to hear that I am not, even though you go into some great detail on it, I don't like kind of track the weight. It's not as forefront on my mind.
I don't blame you for that at all. But I will just tell you that I thought 80 was like ridiculously heavy for her. We were trying to get her back down to 65 pounds. We've been really good about feeding her less. She's looking good. She's moving great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been way less weight loss than I thought it was. I think it was optimistic thinking on my part.
Maybe that's mostly muscle. You know, they say muscle weighs more than fat, right? So maybe it's just kind of like she's toned. She's in good shape. She's got a lot of energy. And she's like the freeze is what she's like. You know, like every single one of those pounds is muscle. That's what I'm going
with. I'm wondering how much of a head start Rudy would need on the freeze, like if they were doing the race, because I think Rudy runs slower than – I've watched probably 4 of the freeze races, and I would say without exaggeration, I think Rudy runs slower than the humans who are running against the freeze. I mean definitely slower than the guy who won, but I mean I think slower than the slow humans. Like I can outrun her. Like if
– You can really outrun her?
Absolutely. 50-yard dash, I can – no question I can outrun her.
Really? Is it that she just would lack motivation halfway through? 25 yards in, she's like, meh.
Well, doesn't help that up until recently she was 80 pounds, and now she's 77 pounds. She has short little legs, and she's kind of uncoordinated, and she kind of runs side saddle. She's had a lot of problems.
God, I'll tell you what, then. I think by race between her and me, we could make it interesting. Because all of those descriptions you just gave of her, with the exception of short legs, also apply to me.
I think you would. I think you would absolutely be able to beat her.
Be able to beat her, or not be able to beat her.
Be able to beat her, or really? Maybe it would be like it might get down to it might be like a photo finish.
What about arm wrestling?
Arm wrestling, she would destroy you.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's like a switch with her, right over the top. You want to play a voicemail?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, this is from listener Kelly, who it seems at first, buckle up for this one, by the way. This is a narrative, Luke. This is a bit of a long one. And it sounds like Kelly's got a pest control problem, but actually it sounds like her problems are a little bit deeper than that. And I don't know if we can help out or not.
Hey, guys, listener Kelly, and I had kind of a Luke situation happen to me with my husband.
You were incredibly handsome.
That's it.
Approaching you on the street asking you what your secret is.
I don't even have to play the rest of it because you got it. So what's your secret, Luke? All right, I'll pick this.
I paint my bald spot.
Hey, guys, listener Kelly, and I had kind of a Luke situation happen to me with my husband this morning. So on Monday, we got this pest control guy came around, and long story, I caught a rat in my live trap, and anyway, so I knew we had rodents and stuff like that. So this pest guy came and he offered me a deal, and I said, yeah, let's go ahead and sign up, and then I'll talk to my husband. So I signed up, and then I asked Derek, and he was like, nah, we don't need that. I'll just spray, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, so I canceled that appointment. So then the next day, another pest guy comes. So I know all these people in my neighborhood are using these pest guys because there's, like, rodent issues. And so he comes, and he's like, let me make you a better deal. So he offered me a better deal, and they were going to do it, you know, that day. They were going to spray and, like, put up the rat trap. And so I said, you know what? Let's do it. Cause I caught that rat, and I was like, I don't want mice and rats and ants and all that jazz. Anyway, so I did it, and I knew, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to ask for forgiveness instead of asking his opinion. So I just did it. And then I thought, you know, maybe he won't even notice. He won't notice those rat traps. They're kind of hidden. So I didn't tell him. And then this morning, he goes out to take the garbage around. And he opens the door and he says, how did we get that rat trap? And I said, what are you talking about? And he goes, I mean, why do we own that rat trap? How did we get that rat trap?
Can you just pause that for a second, Andrew? At first, I was suspicious when Kelly said, I'm having a Luke moment. But when she said that part, I'm like, oh, my God, you're having a Luke moment. When I was on the flight home from Vegas, I needed to pee, and I was in coach. But I was like, the lady next to me was like, you could just use first class. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I could just use first class. I know they say that thing about, like, first class is first class passenger. But I was like, they don't really know the difference. They don't know that I'm not in first class. So I shoot up there. And this flight attendant just like friggin'
oh no,
straight up, you shall not pass as me. And he goes, what row are you in?
Oh my God.
And I have this moment, probably like Kelly when her husband said, where'd we get these rat traps? And she's just cycling through, I would imagine, she's cycling through all the possible stories that she could give. Like, I don't know, the previous owners of the house, maybe, or like, you know. Are those naturally occurring rat traps or
rat on rat violence?
Maybe. I mean, like, I know that feeling because I was thinking, like, do I double down on this and just say row four to this guy? Like, now the problem is he could look past me and see there was two people in row four. So that would that'd be a problem. But that moment when someone's asking you a direct question and you don't want to say the real answer because you think it's going to be you're going to get in trouble or whatever. But you also know that if you lie and get caught, you're making it worse. That's the longest half second of one's life.
So infuriating, that story. So he really did, you shall not pass, and sent you back to the other restroom?
Well, what he did was, he did. I mean, ultimately, yes. He said, what row are you in? And I said,
row eight.
And then he was like, well, we're going to give... He goes, well, you need to use the restroom in the back because we're going to give... The pilots really need a break. And so I think what he was trying to say was that the pilots were about to pee, and so he, you know, he was going to do that thing where they stand in front of the bathroom so that the pilots can use the restroom.
I didn't know that was a thing. That's interesting. Even if he's lying, I give him credit for this because he's making it sound like this is a decision we're making for the pilots, no matter where you're sitting, even if you were a first.
But he asked you which row, though. Exactly. That's what belies that whole thing.
Yeah.
Is that... I'm like, oh, I didn't say this, but the whole way back to the bathroom, I was like, oh, but if I was in row four, what, they don't need a break? I was like, I wanted to really question the underlying thing of his question. It doesn't help, by the way, that like because of all the travel that I've done, I have the good fortune of very frequently getting into first class these days if all the tickets aren't taken. So I kind of feel like, you know, I feel like first class is kind of my people now.
Right.
And I'm like, well, that, I was
now
just
I've
like,
turned on you.
What's that?
I said, now I've turned
you
on
you. You were with me? Listen, I don't feel like if I'm up there, I'm not like a country mouse. I'm not like, oh my God, am I allowed? I'm like, come on, guys. It's a thin, it's a almost translucent curtain separating our lives. And sometimes you're the bar. Sometimes you eat the curtain and sometimes the curtain eats you. And so when I left the plane... I just like when he was like saying bye, 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 I just like stonewalled him. But then to the next flight attendant, I was like, thank you so much.
Oh.
And I think he knew what
I
was
think
up.
He got it. And also, did you tamper God. The heck out of the smoke detector in that bathroom? I hope
I didn't
you did.
Just tamper. I disabled and disassembled and tampered, which, as Adam Carolla always points out, it all falls under tampering. You could just say tampering.
And then you took a big hit off your vape pen.
Yup.
All right. So,
sorry.
What's
back
Kelly's
to Kelly's
deal?
Message.
Okay. Here. So yeah. So her husband
when we
just
left,
found
when we
the
left Kelly's
rat.
When we left Kelly's voicemail, her husband said, "Where did these rat traps come from?" And I believe Kelly probably said something like, "What rat traps?" And he was like, "These ones."
And he goes, "I mean, why do we own that rat trap? How did we get that rat trap?" And so I had to tell him that I signed up because it's not just like a one-time thing when you have a pest control guy. It's like they come the first time and then they come quarterly. So you're signing up for four times a year. They're going to come and spray your house and you know, keep track of the traps. So then I felt awful because I was like, man, I should have talked to him. I shouldn't have been so impulsive. I shouldn't have just, you know, told the guy to do it. And so I feel like kind of like a jerk. maybe this is a lesser offense than buying a boat without telling them.
You think?
I don't know where this ranks in buying, purchasing stuff without talking to your spouse first. So I just felt like a jerk this morning and thought you guys might want to hear my sad tale of pest control. Anywho, Zools, have a great day and power out.
You know, if I were in Kelly's shoes and I got caught making a kind of unilateral decision, because that's the issue there, is that she just went ahead and decided on this without kind of getting her husband to check in on it, and maybe he had a different approach he wanted to do. I think what I would just say is, look, I was really upset by the idea that we had rats. I just wanted to get it done and handled, and I was anxious about it, and this is how my anxiety played out. Might be next time I'll try to loop you in on this. But I think if she's honest, because that's what happens in these situations. And I know this because I'm constantly doing shit like this, you know? Like, you have a feeling, and the way you manage that feeling is by doing something that feels like you're being proactive about whatever it might be. And so then sometimes you'll make a call that isn't – I mean, who knows? Maybe this was the right call too. I mean, I get that the issue is that she didn't consult her husband. But maybe this is the best pest control they've ever had, and at a reasonable rate. And Lord knows her husband doesn't want rats either.
Yeah, I'll take a harder line. I don't think Kelly really has that much to apologize for. I mean, ooh, maybe a quick apology. But listen, this is not – she didn't go out and buy herself a new power glove or a cruise somewhere or something like that. Like, this is a household thing, and she's taking care of business. Mm-hmm. And, you know
– every day.
I know that it tends to be kind of this – it's almost – you know, it is a trope in our society – or in like sitcoms in the 80s, right? Like, there's a plumbing problem and the husband's like, I'll fix it myself. And then it always ends up a disaster. And then you got to call the plumber anyway. I don't know if this is exactly like that. And I don't know if there's a laugh track in their lives, but like, she took care of a household need that really was important. It's not just, well, we're talking about getting the roof fixed, and so now I'm going to sign off on this right away. You got rats, man. You got rats. Like, you need to put a little bit of money into that. You said no the first time. Kelly made a decision on the spot. And I think that my advice is more to the husband. I can't remember his name. Derek? I would say Derek. Like, you should appreciate the fact that Kelly is taking care of this, and it needs to be taken care of.
Now, in Derek's defense, we don't actually know what his response is, other than trying to figure out why there were rat traps. You know
that
what
is
I mean?
True.
Like, he
yeah.
might have, like, the next 5 minutes of their life might have been him saying, all right, cool, sounds good. I will say this, and I mean, God bless it, I don't have much room to talk on relationship stuff or how to be in a relationship, but I will say that if there's anything that I have started to do more of in my life that has helped me in my relationship with my wife, it has been. And this is not one of those like happy wife, happy life things. Mm-hmm. This is real. And this goes for both genders. I think a big thing that everybody needs to do more of in their relationship is just be like, okay. Like, I think if we just said, yeah, okay, more, I think that it would be good for all of us. Because I know for me personally, I have a hard time saying okay if it's not exactly the way I thought it should be, or if I'm future tripping off of like, well, how much is the how much is the, you know, when the guy comes back in 3 months, what's that cost? And now we're locked in, and now we, like, the Orkin Man's going to be here with his hard hat on. By the way, I tweeted that the other day. I saw an ad for the Orkin Man, and I was struck by the fact that he wears a hard hat.
Yeah, that was
and
a
that
funny tweet. Yeah.
Seems unnecessary, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what. Maybe he's building a new Orkin headquarters. And he's a construction worker. That's why he's wearing that. And you just saw it.
Why
out
are
of
they
context.
Sending him out to people's houses? It sounds like he's doing. Sounds like he's wearing a lot of hard hats. He should either be the guy who does the pest remediation, or he's building the new Orkin Center. I don't think the same guy should be doing both stuff.
He's both. He's an ambassador, actually, to get community support for the new Orkin headquarters. I know about this. I've been reading about it in the trades. To get community support for the new Orkin headquarters, sometimes they send out the construction workers to just kind of, you know, say hello to the neighbors and just build goodwill, you know.
The one other thing I'll say, and now that we're out of Doug music, that means it's time to wrap it up. That means it's time to play 14 seconds of a Hood Internet song and then later play a different song. But I told you I'm reading that book, Before the Fall, the Noah Hawley book, and he has a character say something in the book, which I don't even think is really a saying. Like, this guy Noah Hawley probably just wrote it, and I think it's supposed to be almost a little bit like evidence that – I don't know. It's probably sort of evidence that this particular person, this character, isn't some sort of deep thinker. But I swear to God, it's been really jangling around in my head. It sort of gets back to that. Just sometimes it's the best thing is just to be like, yeah, okay. He has this character who says, don't fight tomorrow's battles today, mm-hmm. I always say, or something like that. Don't fight tomorrow's battles today. And I was like, I mean, that's just another way of saying take it one day at a time or mm-hmm. whatever. But for whatever reason, that putting it in those with those words and in that way, it just completely – got inside my head, and I was like, how much of my time do I spend fighting battles that are not even today's battles? They're things I'm worried are going to happen in 6 months, and if I let this one thing go, if I let this person do this now, or if I agree to something in this moment, there's going to be major problems down the road. And it's like, maybe I can probably deal with that stuff if and when it happens, but I'm like, maybe what I should do is each day just actually deal with the battles that are relevant to that day as much as possible. And I swear to God, I read that like 2 days ago, and the last 2 days have been pretty good because I've just been like applying that thought to my life, and actually has been really helpful.
But if it's a battle, you want the element of surprise. You don't want them bringing the battle to you. Sorry, I'm just kidding. You're in a good place.
Sometimes I'll fight tomorrow's battles yesterday, and that'll really fuck them up. Because they are like, what?
It's always about tomorrow's coffee. That's the
yeah, it is.
So I want to talk to you here at
about
the end of this show.
Music?
About music. Because okay. I think the obvious thing would be to go out with one of the Spinal Tap songs off that original album, This Is Spinal Tap. But I'm looking at a list of them, and I don't really like the sound
yeah,
of
no.
these songs.
I love them. Here's the thing. I love those songs within the context of the mm-hmm. so-called mockumentary, because they're pieces of comedy about people doing songs like that. But I don't like them standalone as pieces of music personally. Like,
so we're on the same page there. We don't want to go out with a Spinal Tap song.
No.
Okay.
I'm fine with not going out with a Spinal Tap song. Yeah. Let's see here. I wrote down one show title, by the way.
Oh, good.
Did you write down any show titles?
I wrote down one. Yeah. What's yours?
Okay. Mine is just Regular Swearing, which okay, it's a little kind of lies there on the page.
Technological Fixes for Emotional Life. I like that one.
Whoa,
that sounds like
wow.
That sounds like a book. And Unfortunate Entendres are the two things that I wrote down.
We could just go out. Let's say we could go out with a song by. Oh, what do you like the best of those three possible?
Probably Technological Fixes for Emotional Life. It strikes me as like something that would. I don't know, be a silly book in a movie or something.
Okay. I'm good with that. I'm thinking we did talk about okay. I know we talked about rats, so we could we play the song Round and Round by Rat a lot, but we could play a song by Rat-a-tat. We could also play Your Little Hood Rat Friend by the Hold Steady. I feel like that is a very polarizing song. Like, I love that song, but I've known many people in my life who that song kind of gets on their nerves. Are you familiar?
I don't know that particular song. I got to say, for the most part, I wouldn't be able to like kind of say which song is which for them. They have a sound that I like, but I don't know.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm not surprised if you're kind of medium on the Hold Steady, because it sounds like you're pretty medium on Bruce Springsteen, and the Hold Steady is often sort of compared to him.
I know.
Craig Finn's writing style. I think I've got sort of a soft spot for all that stuff.
I like him more than Springsteen because there's less horns. I don't like my rock and roll infused with too much brass. It's a weird rule. You know, like some people are just kind of like, I don't know, mix. Like, I also don't like to mix salty and sweet. You know, I like horns. I like jazz and I like rock and roll, but I don't like a lot of horns in my rock and roll.
You're not an E Street Band head, I guess.
No, I'm not. Sorry.
Okay. So let's do this. Since you haven't heard this song and I like it a lot, and it has the word rat in it, mm-hmm. and I know it doesn't have the N-word. I think it ticks a lot of boxes.
Okay, great. That's our new standard.
It's a fairly low bar.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening to the show, everybody. We'll be back here tomorrow with more imaginary radio for you. Until then, please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
Hearts to be heartbroken and always being both must be a drag. She's been calling me. Friend's been calling me again, and I can't stand all the things that she sticks into her skin, like sharpened ballpoint pens and steel guitar strings. She says it hurts, but it's worth it. Tiny little text etched into her neck, it said Jesus lived and died for all your sins. She's got blue-black ink, and it's scratched into her lower back. Says damn right I'll rise again. Yeah, damn right you'll rise again. Again. I've been tested in the dark up in Penetration Park, and I've been plastered. I've been shaking hard and searching in a dirty storefront church, and I've been plowed. But I ain't never been with a little mirror friend. Stuck up in Osseo. She said it's funny how true love gets troubled by still water and washed up in the Mississippi River. Her car was pointed at the people. She said St. Teresa came to me in dreams. She said I ain't gonna do anything sexual with you. I'm kind of saving myself for the scene. And I've been dusting in the dark up in Penetration Park, and I've been plastered. I've been shaking on and searching in a dirty storefront church, and I've been proud.
Power out.